Rick Doblin is the founder and president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, aka MAPS. He's going to be here in Austin talking about psychedelic-assisted therapy, the past, the present, and yes, even the future of something that may be legal before too long. He has panel discussions on Friday, March 8th and Saturday, March 9th. For info, perhaps to get tickets or a badge to those events, go to sxsw.com. And to check out more of what MAPS has to offer, all the great research and work and knowledge you can get there, go to maps.org. And Rick is also going to be a part of the Texas Eclipse Festival coming up in April. We may get into that before it's all said and done. Rick, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Trey. I'm here in Miami, and we have a bunch of events here and raising money for group therapy research.
That is part of the name of the game at this point. And you obviously been at this game for a long time now, started all the way back in 1972. Here we are in 2024. I know 50 years feels like a lot. It's more than my lifetime at this current juncture. Are you happy with where things stand after more than 50 years of just putting that nose to the grindstone and trying to help people out in the process?
Well, I think it's better to say I'm astonished. I mean, I never thought that there would be hundreds of for-profit psychedelic companies. And, you know, MAPS has raised about $150 million in donations, but the for-profits have raised several billion, more than $2 billion. So there's an enormous amount of money going into psychedelics. So in addition to that astonishment, I'm also worried that we're just going to see traditional pharma techniques and strategies come from all these investors and patents and blocking generics and bad behavior and trying to minimize therapy. So I'm both astonished and delighted by where we're at, and also worried and concerned at the same time.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit more later on, because that is a current challenge. I think there's a couple of other challenges, too, that are worth addressing. First, though, I wanted to provide a little bit of a primer for people who may be listening on the podcast or radio show right now who hear the word psychedelics and it just freaks them out immediately. There is a lot of good research that has gone into a number of different psychedelics that show immense benefit for things like depression, anxiety, PTSD. So I'd like to, if you don't mind, to give a little bit of a rundown of some of these drugs that I'm going to list and just tell the people just why there is such potential benefit with some of these things and various issues that that present themselves that people struggle with for a long time. So let's go ahead and start with something that I think is finally starting to turn the corner after the William Randolph Hearst era really set it back in the 1920s and 30s, and that would be cannabis. What are some of the potential medicinal benefits of cannabis, Rick?
Well, I should add that one of our supporters who's supporting the psychedelic community at large is Austin Hearst.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, thank you for trying to walk that one back a little bit, Austin.
Yeah. Kids and grandkids of some of these early people are really, more open-minded in a lot of different ways. So cannabis, there was an article that appeared yesterday in the Washington Post about the FDA and our struggles with the FDA to do cannabis research. So, you know, there's somewhere like 39 states which have medical marijuana. There's over 20 states have marijuana legalization. I think there's and yet the FDA, the same group at the FDA that has been open to our work with MDMA and open to other work with psychedelics, is blocking our research with cannabis. So it's just outrageous. We have a $12.9 million grant from the state of Michigan. And when Michigan legalized cannabis, the initiative said that they had to put $40 million, $20 million a year for 2 years, into research into veterans, mental health, and suicide prevention with cannabis in FDA-approved studies. So we've been trying to do that. Other people have been trying to do that. And the FDA is blocking us from studying smoked marijuana. And the FDA is blocking us from studying vaporized marijuana. And I think here's a clue as to why they're doing this. The entire critique of vaporized marijuana that we got from the FDA was completely missing the whole point. It was about isolated cannabinoids in vape pens with oils that do have some health issues. But we weren't even talking about that at all. We were talking about the flower and a vaporizer like the PAX, where it just heats up the flower. There's no isolated cannabinoids. There's no oils. There's nothing like that. So
combustion that has a carcinogenic effect too, correct?
Well, even if there's combustion, there is no evidence that cannabis leads to lung cancer.
Mm.
So that there are anti-tumor properties in the cannabinoids. Some of them have anti-tumor properties. So we're not exactly sure why it is, but there is no evidence that cannabis leads to lung cancer. And that's been demonstrated by decades and decades of research by Dr. Donald Tashkin at UCLA, funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So even the National Institute on Drug Abuse has given up the claim that cannabis causes lung cancer. So there's the where we're at with cannabis is because the FDA has been blocking cannabis research. And before that, it was the DEA, where there was a monopoly on the supply of federally legal cannabis that could be used in FDA-approved studies, because FDA is a federal agency and it can only work with federally legal cannabis. So all the cannabis that's state legal in multiple different states cannot be used by the FDA because it's not federally legal. And this one supplier at the University of Mississippi supplied under contract to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and NIDA would provide it to researchers, but it was only for research. It could not be used for commercial purposes. And so with the FDA, when you move to phase three, which is the final stage of the studies where you have to do double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized controlled studies to demonstrate safety and efficacy, you have to use the exact same drug that you want to market. So since the monopoly was on NIDA-funded marijuana that could not be used for phase three because it could not be used for commercial purposes, that's how the FDA and the DEA and the federal government conspired, you could say, to block cannabis research. Now, it's only been a couple of years that we've been able to overturn this monopoly. I mean, MAPS started working on that in 2000. So it's taken 24 years, or last year, actually, they finally gave some licenses to Sue Sisley and some others to grow cannabis domestically. But for our project, we're talking about importing 20% THC from Canada. So I think one of the things that was so amusing to me was that when we had a meeting with the FDA in person to talk about the blockages where they won't let us study smoked marijuana and they won't let us study vaporized marijuana, the woman that's the head of the Division of Psychiatry said, "I hate this term medical marijuana because it's not medical until we say it is." And I'm like, well, you know, that's pretty good. You're blocking us from doing the research and you're saying you're the only ones that can say it's medical. Well, look at all these states and look at all these patients and look at all these doctors. They think it's medical. So it's cannabis is in a very interesting position. The problem, I would say, of the FDA blockage is that medical marijuana patients have to pay for it themselves. It's not covered by insurance.
Yeah.
Because insurance wants you to prove it through the FDA. And if you haven't proven it, then why should they cover it? And if you can't go through the FDA, then they're not going to cover it. So if we can make cannabis through the FDA for PTSD, then it can be covered. Now, I should say that from our point of view, cannabis is palliative, not curative, in that it just controls the symptoms. People who use cannabis for PTSD tend to use it every day, or maybe they'll skip some days, but they use it to help them sleep. They use it to keep them present focused. It can be very useful. And there's a lot of people that want it, but it doesn't actually get to the root cause of the traumatic memories that are problematic, the way we think we can do with MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, or other people think that they can do with ketamine, psilocybin, ibogaine, other things as well. So what we're trying to do is really open the door, not just to our research with cannabis for PTSD, but for everybody who wants to study cannabis in any different clinical condition, with the goal of moving through the FDA and then making it into something that's covered by insurance. And yet, because of the blockage of FDA, we see all the states just saying, hey, the federal system is blocked. We need state reform. And that's what we have with cannabis.
Let's talk a little bit about MDNA right now, because in a lot of ways, this is the one that is most important for this overall fight because it is furthest down the road with DFDA. So what has the research from MAPS and elsewhere shown about the potential medicinal therapeutic benefits of MDMA?
Well, let's say that I started MAPS in 1986. So 72 is when I was devoting my life to psychedelics to try to, you know, help people feel interconnected and then, you know, have that be a basis for peace and appreciating differences rather than killing people for differences. 84 is when I started a nonprofit before MAPS to try to protect the therapeutic use of MDMA, because it was clear that the MDMA was a therapy drug under the code name Atom. But it had also sort of escaped into sort of recreational context under the name ecstasy. And so it was doing that in public at a time that Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan were in office and just say no and escalation of the drug war. So it was clear that the federal government was going to come after MDMA at some point, ecstasy at some point. So we formed, we as the underground therapists and the psychedelic researchers above ground and others, formed this group to try to protect the therapeutic use of MDMA. And so we ended up being ahead of the game. And so 84 is when the DEA moved to criminalize MDMA. We sued them in the appeals court, in the DEA administrative law judge hearings. We won. The judge said it should be Schedule 3, available as a medicine, but illegal as ecstasy. And the DEA rejected the recommendations. We sued a couple times in the appeals courts, won twice, and eventually the DEA lawyers figured out how to criminalize it. But while this was all going on, I realized that they were going to block it, and we needed to go through the FDA. So 86 is when I started MAPS. From 86 to 92, we had five different protocols all rejected from Harvard Medical School, UC San Francisco, University of Arizona, Albuquerque, and other academic research plant, all was shut down. And there had been multiple decades of psychedelic research being shut down. So in 92 is when the FDA had a advisory committee and decided that they would open the door to psychedelic research. So through the 90s, we did what's called phase one studies. These are dose response safety studies where you try to understand what happens at various doses and what are the safety issues. And then you try to figure out what it might be for, because this was, again, in healthy volunteers. We started the work with PTSD in 1999 in Spain in 2000. And then it was unfortunately shut down. That was for PTSD, for women survivors of rape and sexual assault. And it was shut down for political reasons by the Madrid Anti-Drug Authority. We started in the U.S. finally in 2003. And till the end of 2016, we did what's called phase two pilot studies, where you check out which kind of PTSD patients does it work in? What are the doses? Is it one session, two sessions, three sessions? What are your measures? All of that. And we got great information. And November 29th, 2016, we went to the FDA and said, it's called an end of phase two meeting. And so we did that. And FDA said, yes, you can go to phase three. And so we then engaged in an 8-month process called special protocol assessment, where you negotiate every aspect of the protocol design and the safety information, the statistical analysis plan, all of that. The goal is to get an agreement letter, which we did get. So what an agreement letter generally means is that FDA is legally obligated to approve MDMA or whatever the drug it is, if the agreed upon protocol gets statistically significant evidence of efficacy, if there's no new safety problems, and if the data is gathered properly. So in 2018 is when we started phase three. And in 2021, we published the results in Nature Medicine of our first phase three study. And at the end of 2021, the journal Science comes up with a list of the top 10 scientific breakthroughs in the entire world. And Science said that our study was one of the top 10 scientific breakthroughs. The results were excellent, but also I think we got this award mainly because it was, we're the front runner of the entire field of psychedelic assisted therapy. And they were wanting to point to that. It was particularly satisfying for us because 20 years before in 2002, Science had published this paper that was completely bogus. They never should have published it. And it was about claiming that MDMA, given to primates hurt dopamine and could cause Parkinson's in humans. And the editor of Science put out a press release saying taking MDMA was like playing Russian roulette with your brain. It didn't make sense, and we challenged it. And eventually, after a year of trying to replicate the results, the scientists said, oops, we mistakenly administered methamphetamine instead of MDMA. And if you know, methamphetamine is stronger than MDMA, so they're giving methamphetamine and MDMA doses, and they knocked off some of the primates from overdose, which we had done primate studies before and none had died. So it should have been a signal. But in any case, they had to withdraw that. And that was sort of the high watermark of fears of MDMA neurotoxicity. And so for all those years later in 2021, for science to say MDMA research, top 10 scientific breakthroughs in the world, was particularly satisfying. And then in September of last year, 2023, we published the second phase three studies, also in Nature Medicine. And the results are extremely statistically significant. We had an excellent safety record. And to give you a sense of what the results were, we felt that because of the stigma of psychedelics, it was necessary for us to work with the hardest cases. So we enroll people that have previously attempted suicide. Almost one third of the people in our first study with severe PTSD had what's called positive behavior, meaning you either had attempted to kill yourself or you had done something to move in that direction. Like you went to the hardware store and bought a rope to hang yourself, but then you didn't hang yourself. Or you went to a bridge and you thought about jumping off, but you didn't do that, or whatever. So we worked with the hardest cases with severe PTSD. People had PTSD an average of 14 years. One third had PTSD over 20 years. We had people with PTSD from any cause, and they had, almost all of them had tried psychotherapy, pharmacotherapy, one or the other, or both, and had still had severe PTSD for extended periods of time. And it's 42 hours of therapy. So it's labor intensive. It's 3 8-hour sessions, 1 month apart. And we have two people. One has to be licensed as a therapist. The second is got to have a bachelor's degree and 1,000 hours of behavioral health experience. Could be more like an intern or a student. And within these 3 8-hour sessions, we also have 12 90-minute non-drug psychotherapy sessions. So basically, really, it's important to think about this. This is really therapy. The MDMA makes the therapy more effective, but it's not here. The treatment is the MDMA. This is different than esketamine, which Spravato, which has been approved for depression, but without any therapy at all. And it doesn't work as well as when you combine it with therapy. All right, so there's 12 90-minute sessions, three before the first MDMA session for preparation, build the therapeutic alliance, and three of these 90-minute meetings after each MDMA session for integration. And then the primary outcome measure is 2 months after the last experimental session. So one group gets all of this therapy with a pill that has MDMA. The other group gets all this therapy with a pill that has nothing in it. And so what we showed is the people that got the pill with nothing in it, 32% of them no longer had PTSD at the 2 month follow-up, which is amazing. These are people that had tried all sorts of other things, severe PTSD, 14 years on average. And I think it means that our therapeutic approach by itself is can be quite effective. You know, a lot of, well, here's a good example. The Veterans Administration did a study. It took them 6 or so years to do, 916 veterans, and they compared two psychotherapies, prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy. And what they showed is that roughly 50% of the people in the study dropped out because the therapy was so re-traumatizing, because you talk about your trauma over and over and you're in these 1 hour meetings and you got to get there. You got to relax a bit. It takes a few minutes to do that. Then you start talking about stuff and then you got to think, okay, now I got to get out and walk down the street and, you know, and now I have to pull myself back together. And the whole time they're just talking to you about this one index trauma in prolonged exposure. So there's major, major dropouts. And the results that you get from these studies are only the people that made it through. We had hardly any dropouts. Our second phase three study was 2%. The first one was about a little bit more than 10%. So people stay in the study. And so what we showed is when you add MDMA, instead of 32%, now it's 2/3 no longer have PTSD. And another one, 21% have clinically significant reductions of PTSD symptoms, meaning that they're responders, but they still have PTSD. So maybe they could have used a fourth session or over more time, they'll learn. We try to teach people how to heal themselves so that they can deal with further traumas that come up without having a relapse. So we sort of teach people you can process these emotions. You don't need to run away and cover them up with alcohol or feel overwhelming. We can help you. The MDMA helps you. The therapeutic context helps you. The second phase three study was moderate to severe PTSD. And with that group, it was around 46% got no longer had PTSD in the control group. Therapy without MDMA, pretty incredible. But when you add MDMA, it's 72%. And another 15% was responders that had clinically significant reductions of PTSD symptoms. So we have 88 or 87% response rate, doesn't work for everybody. And then the safety issue is really important. We had very much acute, temporary, transient, non-serious side effects during the MDMA, muscle tension, sweating, jaw clenching, different things that faded with the MDMA. And we didn't have cardiovascular problems, or we didn't have any. Now, these are screened people. We screen out people that have uncontrolled hypertension.
Sure.
But we had no evidence really that people went on to become ecstasy abusers. And in the first study, we had one woman try to kill herself twice and fortunately did not succeed other times. And one woman had such severe suicidal ideation that she checked herself into a hospital not to kill herself. Both of these women were in the control group, not in the MDMA group. So we didn't have any of that kind of activity in the MDMA group. And then people, a lot of people have heard, oh, Suicide Tuesdays, after you take MDMA, you're depleted, your serotonin is depleted, and you go through a depression. We did not see that any more in the MDMA group than in the control group. It's struggling with PTSD that impacts people. So I think the part of the reason, though, is that we give it to people at 10 in the morning. It's a 10-hour session till 6 p.m. Often they can sleep that night. They don't take it with alcohol. They don't take it with any other drugs. It's pure. And then they rest. And then the next day, we say, rest the next day. Don't have any appointments. And we're going to have the therapist come back and talk to you to do the integration. So I think that's what really is influencing this sense that we don't have this Suicide Tuesdays, Blue Mondays, things like that. So on December 11th, we submitted all of this information to the FDA in what's called a new drug application. I should distinguish to say that MAPS is the nonprofit that I started in 86. And in 2014, we started the MAPS Public Benefit Corp, which is a public benefit for-profit pharma company with the thought that it could be entirely owned by the nonprofit. And then it was public benefit. And then that would ensure good behavior. Unfortunately, I mentioned the rise of all these for-profit psychedelic companies. That made it more difficult for us to raise more donations because people are like, why should I donate? Look at all these people trying to make money. Why don't I just want to invest? So we had to take investors. Fortunately, we have the best kind of investors, which are called impact investors. They're not investors like your biotech VC firms that want 10x and want in and out and want you to 10x their money in several years. And so we have people that care about making money, their money back, but they also really care about the impact on the world. So that's really good. So we submitted all this information on December 11th. February 9th, the FDA said, we accept the file, and that starts a 6-month review process. We've been given what's called priority review. So by August 11th, the FDA has to tell Lykos, they changed the name from MAPS Public Benefit Corp. I raised a wolf when I was 21 to 23, Alaskan timber wolf that I got from the Humane Society. And that was a big part of my personality. So Lykos is the Greek word for wolf. So the name is a slight nod to me and to the origins of the company. But by August 11th, we're hoping to hear from FDA about whether they approve prescription use of MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD.
So we're going to push ahead a little bit now. We don't have time to go over all these different drugs. So you're just going to have to go to maps.org to learn more about LSD, ayahuasca. I did want to ask about ibogaine, though, because we
Yes,
obviously are
thank you.
dealing with an opioid epidemic in this country. And ibogaine is a massive potential solution to all of this. What has research bore out with regards to this? And what exactly is ibogaine?
Well, there's a root, the iboga plant, and the root is contains the chemical ibogaine, but it's been used for quite a long time, centuries and centuries and centuries, by the Bwiti religion in Gabon. And so it's as we see, the Native American Church has peyote as part of their sacrament. Other groups have ayahuasca as part of their sacraments. Mushrooms have been used in religious ceremonies, and so ayahuasca, they all have this kind of religious context. Iboga also has the same thing. It's been used by the Bwiti, but it is a psychedelic drug. And in the 60s, there was some people that were LSD dealers who were also addicted to heroin, and they wanted to try another psychedelic, ibogaine. And what they found is that it cut through the withdrawal from the opiates. No other drug does that we know of. And it also gives you a profound psychological experience. You could look at the roots of addiction. Why is it that you're sort of running away into addictive behavior? So the DEA busted these LSD dealers. It wasn't the DEA then, but the police busted these LSD dealers, and they saw, oh, they had ibogaine. Let's criminalize that too. So ibogaine is illegal in the United States, but it's legal in Canada, Mexico, England, most of the world. It's not illegal. It is not a drug of abuse. And as a result, so many people with opiate overdose or opiate dependence problems, but also with PTSD, with depression, with traumatic brain injury, particularly veterans, have not been getting the help that they need at the VA. So there's a group called Vets, Marcus and Amber Capone, and they've now raised money to fund about more than 800 people, I think, mostly special operators from the military, Navy SEALs and others, to go down to Mexico for ibogaine. And then at the end of it, it's like a 4 or 5 day experience. They also receive 5-MeO-DMT, which is from the Sonoran Desert Toad. It's the most powerful psychedelic that we're aware of. And so several people, a bunch of these people who went down to Ambio Life, a clinic there that works with vets, went to Stanford and had brain scans and stuff before and after. And what they showed is that the ibogaine really does restore certain neural connections. For people that had TBI, it can be very, very effective. This is now called neuroplasticity. And that happens with all the psychedelics, as far as we can tell. It helps you to actually rewire your brain, which also points to how serious this is. If you take it in a bad circumstance where you don't feel safe, you can end up worse off. So it's, again, it's the context that really determines it. But with 100,000 plus people dying from opiate overdoses, what's been inspiring to me is that the state of Kentucky, which was getting roughly $840 million from the pharma industry for the terrible damage that they did for the promoting the opiate epidemic, Purdue Pharma and other companies that marketed it, intermediaries, all sorts of even some of the BCG, I think. I'm not exactly sure, but which some of these consulting companies gave terrible, advice.
Which barely puts a dent in the profits that they made throughout that horrible time.
Yes, that's true. That is very true. But at least it's something. And
Yeah.
so Kentucky said, well, for a while, working out of the Attorney General's office, Brian Hubbard started saying that they would put $42 million into ibogaine research, not just into providing services, but trying to work for more the most effective treatment that they had heard of. In the end, a new attorney general squashed that, but other states may follow through. So what we're hoping to do at MAPS is to use not investor money, but public money and donor money. We'd need about 80 to 100 million over 4 to 5 years to develop ibogaine into a medicine through the FDA, but do it completely open science with no patents and turn it immediately into a generic. But that's something that we cannot do if we get money from investors, because investors are like, oh, generics don't make that much money. Well, which is the point, actually, to try to get it more widely available because it's a national crisis and an international crisis. And iboga and ibogaine have remarkable properties for PTSD, for depression, for traumatic brain injury, for addiction, for, you know, I have done it one time, 1985, and it was one of the most powerful and profound psychedelic experiences of my life. It was one of the most difficult. I guess that helps explain why I haven't done it since then. But I think it's the next most important thing. And to say another sort of political overlay, which is, you know, there's a lot of people in America that have lost hope in America, lost hope in their prospects for being in the middle class, lost trust in the administration, lost trust in all of our institutions. And they're often out of fear and anxieties that they're able to be, they're in despair. And so there's actually what is called deaths of despair, which are deaths from alcoholism, suicide, and overdoses. And so these deaths of despair take place more in, not only, but in a lot of rural areas that have lost jobs, that are facing cultural change. So I think if we can bring ibogaine to bear on where people are having these struggles with opiate dependence and other things, that we can help people to both work through the dependence, have these psychological experiences that are really important, and we can, in many cases, help people feel connected. One of the big things about despair is you feel disconnected. You're all by yourself. You're not. And so when you have these classic psychedelic experiences that sort of weaken your ego sense but connect you to something larger, people can have spiritual experiences and they feel more connected. So I think from a political point of view, ibogaine after MDMA is the next most important thing that we could be delivering to the American public.
Psilocybin is also having its day in the sun right now, Rick. There are states that are starting to decriminalize or legalize small amounts of psilocybin. And there's a difference in the amount that you take, just like with any of these things that we're talking about. And remember, we're talking about psychedelic-assisted therapy. So self-medicating could be much more harmful than helpful. Based on that, though, I'm curious, because I know a lot of people who are microdosing at this point in 2024. Has there been any research that is backing some of the anecdotal stuff that people are talking about with regards to the benefits that they're receiving from microdosing psilocybin?
Well, okay, let's distinguish between macrodosing, full doses of psilocybin, and microdosing. The evidence that has been gathered from studies of microdosing, mostly they've looked at some of the early ones, looking at creativity. You know, people talk about how it gives them, let me say this. There was a study with psilocybin that was called semantic priming. And what that means, and this was not microdosing, but what it means is that if I say day, people normally say night. If I say sun, you say moon. You know, it's if I say man, you say woman, things like that. So it's semantic priming. You say a word and you prime somebody to say a normal. Under the influence of psilocybin, they showed that people had a wider range of associations. Hmm. They weren't stuck in these normal kind of, oh, this is the pattern. So that's been interpreted to mean that people can be more creative, that you hear something and you can draw from a wider range of associations. So the thought was that microdosing makes people have more insightful ideas, or that they can be a bit more creative. So the studies that were done initially with LSD and microdosing for creativity failed. And so the sense was that maybe the measures aren't that sensitive, or maybe the people that volunteer are already pretty creative, but it has not been demonstrated in controlled studies that microdosing is helpful for creativity.
Mm.
So maybe it's a placebo effect. On the other hand, there's people that microdose for depression and say that it gives them a bit of a lift of energy and it's helpful. So that has not been studied in the same way. But I do think that there's so many anecdotal reports of microdosing being helpful in a range of different things. Even though the controlled studies have not demonstrated it, I think we need more controlled studies, different measures, and not just looking at creativity, but looking at mood, things like that. But I would say that from MAPS's perspective, what we're really wanting to do is to help people be free of drugs. and help. I mean, it might sound weird from a drug company or from a psychedelic advocate, but what we want to do, particularly free of drugs for clinical conditions, we want to do macrodosing with therapy to get to the root of the problems. So with microdosing, often people take it every day or take it several days and then don't take it a few days and then take it again several days. But we want to really help people get to the root of the problem so they can work through it. And then they feel great. I've changed my baseline. Maybe I'll do psilocybin for spiritual experiences, but I'm not doing it for depression or anxiety or fear of death or whatever. So I guess all of that is to say that there is incredible developing evidence about full doses of psilocybin with therapy for a wide range of clinical conditions, from depression to nicotine addiction to alcoholism to cocaine dependence to obsessive compulsive disorder. There's some now starting to look at psilocybin for PTSD. Psilocybin with therapy is got enormous potential. And I think that a couple years after, if FDA does indeed make MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD into a prescription medicine, a couple years after that, psilocybin will be approved. A company called Compass is doing it for treatment resistant depression. A company called USONA is doing it for major depression disorder. There's other companies, BMOR, that are looking at it for alcoholism. So I think that we will see a lot of FDA action and hopefully approvals for psilocybin. Meanwhile, as you mentioned, a lot of states and cities, different areas are approving plant psychedelics, and like the Oregon Psilocybin Initiative and the Colorado Natural Plant Medicine Initiative. And it's going to be on the ballot in Massachusetts in November. I'm not sure when it'll get around to Texas, but it may take a while. But it's happening. And so there are state training programs for guides and therapists. And the advantage of these state programs is people can come not just because they've got depression, anxiety, PTSD diagnosis, but also for personal growth, for spirituality, for creativity, for whatever. So we're seeing more and more of that also with psilocybin. So I think we're at a stage where the culture is really moving very close to the, we don't know where the tipping point is with the acceptance of psychedelics. Some people say we've already passed it. I would say the tipping point is when FDA says yes to MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD.
Yeah, and there are some inherent challenges here. One is education, which you and MAPS are doing a great job of helping to inform the general public. Another is drug policy reform to the point that you just made. And a third thing that I think is crucial too, Rick, and I know you've talked a little bit about this, is making sure, because again, we're talking about psychedelic assisted therapy. The person helping with the therapy, the therapist, has a lot of power in their hands when we're talking about somebody whose mind is being altered by psychedelic drugs, is making sure that the therapists are qualified to do so because of that power that they possess at that point in time. Is there an obvious solution to make sure that if and when drug policy reform does flip and this becomes pretty immediately available to the public, that there are people out there who will truly be able to help with the therapy side of all of this?
Well, you put your finger on it. I mean, the key to scaling is going to be two things. One is training more therapists. The other is studying group therapy. And that may be really helpful. But I think the challenge with training new therapists is that we believe, and every therapist believes, that if they're going to be administering MDMA or psilocybin or whatever to their patients, they will be more effective if they've done the drug themselves.
Yeah.
And how do we create those contexts that are legal, inexpensive? That's the big challenge. We're working with a company called Numinous in Vancouver. They're going to try to create a protocol to give MDMA to therapists as part of their training, but in a group setting. But right now we're administering it practically in a individual setting. So that's good, but they're trying to do that to reduce the costs. The FDA has given us protocols. Lykos has given Lykos protocols for giving, and before that MAPS, to give MDMA to therapists as part of their training. But those are expensive. Those are data gathering. So I think the key challenge is going to be really training more therapists and finding ways for them to have their own psychedelic experiences as part of their training. And eventually, I would say maybe 4 or 5 years from now, after FDA's approved MDMA and after FDA's approved psilocybin, schools of psychotherapy and psychiatry, we hope this becomes part of the core curriculum. And then that's what's really going to be solving the problem going forward, is that, you know, people who want to become psychiatrists will have modules in how to become a psychedelic therapist. The other thing to say is that the clinics of the future, right now there's well over 700 ketamine clinics. But the world of the future is not going to be a ketamine clinic here, an MDMA clinic there, a psilocybin clinic there. The therapist, what we're really trying to do is bring forth psychedelic medicine. And we want the therapist to be cross-trained in all the different drugs and then customize a treatment program for each individual patient. Maybe some people start with psilocybin. Maybe some people start with MDMA. Maybe some people go right to Ibogaine when they're dealing with opiate addiction. But we want the therapist, ideally, to be cross-trained. And then the psychedelic clinics that you go to will be able to provide any number of these different psychedelic treatments in this kind of customized way. So there's a lot of work. There's 13 million PTSD patients in America. What we're talking about at Lykos is training 25,000 therapists by the end of 2030 and treating a little bit over 1 million PTSD patients by 2032. But that's pathetic in a way. I mean, that's less than 10% of the PTSD patients, and that's till 2032. Now, that doesn't count group therapy, so that may alter that phenomenally. But, you know, you basically put your finger on it. What is the key to scaling? And that's training therapists.
Yeah, you may be right about the group therapy aspect of it, because there's going to be a scramble once this happens. It's going to happen eventually. It's just a matter of when. And so, group therapy may be the key that may be helping to mine the gap in the meantime before you have more individuals able to do more one-on-one type sessions.
Well, Trey, I think that's exactly right. And so that's why I'm here. I'm here in Miami. We're raising money for group therapy in Israel. 400 people. It'll be experimenting different numbers of therapists, different numbers of assistants, different numbers of people in the group. And these are people that have been traumatized together. And also at the Portland, Oregon VA, they've just started, Christopher is the principal investigator, has just started a group therapy project there. And it'll be 4 therapists for 6 veterans with PTSD. The difference between the two studies is that in the Portland, Oregon setting, people will get an individual session first before they do it together in a group. And in the Israeli studies, people will get 2 MDMA sessions also, but both in a group. So we'll see how that works.
All right. I'm really excited because you're going to be here in Central Texas a couple of times over the next month plus. First at South by Southwest next Friday and Saturday. The Friday session is Philanthropy, Psychedelics, and Healing at the Austin Convention Center. The next day is going to be the Future of Psychedelics, Drug Development, and Policy Reform, also at the Austin Convention Center in room 18AB. And then you're going to be back in April. MAPS is actually celebrating the 38th anniversary at the Texas Eclipse Festival. That's right. The Path of Totality rips its way through Central Texas that weekend of April 8th. And you guys are going to be there and you're going to be a part of a psychedelic speaker series. You are obviously going to be speaking, Allison and Alex Gray. Paul Stamets, there's so many different people. I'm not going to list them all right now, but that brings me to a little bit of an issue that I have, Rick, because a good friend of mine who's getting married in May decided to put his bachelor party that weekend. And initially he thought by having us drive 7.5 hours to Terlingua, which is this little, this artist community on the Texas-Mexico border, that we were going to get to see this total eclipse, but that's not going to happen. We're out of the Path of Totality. So should I go to this bachelor party, which, mind you, how do I put this diplomatically? There will be some things ingested that may cause a sort of eclipse of the soul, if you will. Do I go to the bachelor party? Do I stick around for this once-in-a-lifetime event that is this Path of Totality solar eclipse here in Central Texas?
Well, here's my general advice on that, is that whenever I'm confronted with either or kind of questions, I always try to figure out, how can I do both? Is there any way? So I wonder if you could change the bachelor party to the seetexaseclipse.com and camp out with 40,000 other people And then you can do both. You can have the eclipse of the soul, you can have the eclipse of the sun, and you can be with the rest of the people in the bachelor party, and you can be listening to music, and you can be hanging out. So maybe there is some way to do that. But I guess I would say that, you know, friendships are critical to our health. So if I had to advise you one or the other, I would advise the bachelor party, but maybe you could move it.
The hell of an idea there, Rick. That's why I had to ask you. I knew that you would give me a creative solution there. He is Rick Doblin, founder and president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Find out more info at maps.org. You can see him at South by Southwest next Friday and Saturday. That is March 8th and 9th. Go to sxsw.com to get a badge or at least tickets to these two different events. And then you can also check out that Texas Eclipse Festival through their Instagram page at Texas_Eclipse. Rick, thank you so much for the time today. This has been a real honor, sir. I really appreciate all the efforts that you're making in this world to try and make this world a better place. And hey, if you're up for it, maybe we can speak again just prior to that Texas Eclipse Festival. We'd love to get into this a little bit more if you don't mind.
Yeah, Trey, I think that would be really good. That'd be really good. And good luck with the bachelor's party.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. And thanks to you for hanging out. For more of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. Talk to you next time, Books on Pod.